KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This movie afforded me the opportunity to go back to my more recent lineage, 100 years or so, and go back to, the Mississippi, a state that I had never been to.
We speak to the celebrated Hollywood director Ryan Coogler about his new film, Sinners, a horror film about two brothers fighting an evil force in Jim Crow, Mississippi.
I ain't ever seen no demons. No ghosts. No magic. Till now.
Then to a real story in Memphis, Tennessee, about two brothers fighting Elon Musk, the richest man in the world.
XAI, Elon Musk's company, is operating 35 gas turbines in southwest Memphis, in the neighborhood where myself and my entire family lives. This is horrific news.
So we found an Electrolux factory in Memphis. That's why it's in Memphis. Home of Elvis.
How is it good for Memphis if it continues to pollute our air? How is it good for Memphis when the community is locked out?
We'll go to Memphis to speak with brothers Keyshawn Pearson and Tennessee State Representative Justin Pearson. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Gaza. Israeli attacks have killed more than 60 people since early Thursday, bringing the death toll since Israel shattered a ceasefire agreement last month to nearly 2,000. Among the recent dead are a family of five, a pregnant mother, a father, and their three children, who were killed by an Israeli drone strike on their tent in the southern Gaza Strip. Another strike early Thursday collapsed a home in Gaza City, killing a Palestinian former prisoner and his entire family.
Our neighbor was imprisoned for 13 years, and after he was released, he got married and had children. His eldest daughter is 8 years old, and his youngest son is a year and a half old. He was born during the war. Ali al-Sarafiti's entire family died and was erased from the civil registry, along with his siblings and himself. They all died.
Israel's military on Thursday offered a rare apology to the United Nations after an Israeli tank shelled a guest house in Gaza last month, killing a UN staff member and wounding six others. Israel initially denied responsibility. Israeli attacks have killed at least 285 UN workers since October 2023. President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, has arrived in Moscow for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. His visit comes a day after President Trump called out Putin in a rare rebuke after a major Russian airstrike on Kyiv killed 12 people and injured dozens of others. Posting on social media, Trump wrote, quote, "Vladimir, stop." The word stop in all caps, adding, quote, "Let's get the peace deal done." But later on Thursday, Trump insisted Putin has made great progress towards establishing peace with Ukraine.
What concessions has Russia offered up thus far to get to the point where you're closer to peace?
Stopping the war, stopping taking the whole country. Pretty big concession.
Overnight, a Russian drone strike on an apartment building in the southeastern city of Pavlorod killed three civilians and injured 14 others. Meanwhile, Russian media is reporting a senior Russian military officer was killed this morning in a car bomb attack outside Moscow. The Trump administration is poised to offer Saudi Arabia a weapons deal worth well over $100 billion. That's according to Reuters, which reports President Trump will announce the deal during a trip to Saudi Arabia next month, the first country he'll visit during his second term in office. In 2017, Trump made a similar trip to Riyadh as the first overseas visit of his first term. That same year, he proposed a $110 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia. Indian and Pakistani forces have exchanged cross-border fire as tensions mount between the nuclear-armed nations following Tuesday's shooting attack in Indian-administered Kashmir that killed 26 people. On Thursday, Pakistan closed its airspace to India and threatened to halt all bilateral agreements with India. A group called the Resistance Front has claimed responsibility for the massacre. Islamabad has rejected India's claims the attack was supported by Pakistan. On Thursday, Kashmiris took to the streets to call for an end to the violence.
We strongly condemn this terrible act that has been done day before yesterday. And we just want to say that terrorism doesn't have a particular religion. And we as common Kashmiris stand for peace and will always stand for peace.
A federal judge Thursday blocked part of Trump's executive order requiring documentary proof of U.S. citizenship to register to vote in federal elections. Trump's order was issued in an attempt to circumvent Congress. Earlier this month, the Republican-led House passed the measure as part of a voter suppression bill known as the SAVE Act. But Senate Democrats vowed to block the bill through a filibuster. In a statement, the ACLU said, quote, this executive order is part of a broader attack on our democratic elections by promoting baseless nativist conspiracy theories. Today, the court blocked a key strategy of this attack, they said. President Trump's calling for the Justice Department to investigate Act Blue, the online fundraising platform used by most Democratic politicians. Trump accused Act Blue of allowing fraudulent donations. Act Blue called the claims baseless. WinRed, the Republican fundraising platform, has also faced reports of donor-related issues, though is not named in Trump's memo to Attorney General Pam Bondi. ActBlue's CEO Regina Wallace-Jones called Trump's probe, quote, the next version of the big lie. A federal judge in California has barred the Trump administration from denying or placing conditions on federal funds to sanctuary cities and counties that limit cooperation with federal immigration agencies. Meanwhile, a federal judge in Maryland has ordered the Trump administration to facilitate the return of a 20-year-old Venezuelan immigrant who is among the group of over 200 transferred from the United States to El Salvador in March. District Judge Stephanie Gallagher, who was appointed by Trump, said his expulsion from the U.S. violated a previous court settlement that protected him from removal while his asylum case was pending. The asylum seeker, who's been identified only as Christian, was part of a class-action lawsuit filed in 2019 by a group of undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as unaccompanied children. Three federal judges on Thursday blocked Trump's plans to cut federal funding from K-12 schools that have DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. In one case, Judge Landia McCafferty called Trump's move, quote, textbook viewpoint discrimination, and said the Education Department, quote, does not even define what a DEI program is. In related news, President Trump signed an executive order this week targeting college accreditors, private companies that determine whether universities meet standards for federal funding. Trump accused the accreditors of supporting DEI initiatives and, quote, allowing our colleges to become dominated by Marxist maniacs, unquote. The order would enable the Trump administration to revoke approval from accreditors that factor DEI into their evaluations. Students at the City College of New York rallied on campus Thursday to demand their administration divest from Israel and prioritize student safety amidst a mounting crackdown on rights across higher education. Students established what they call the Hilmi al-Bakawi Liberated Zone, a tribute to the slain journalist who was killed when Israel struck a press tent in Khan Yunis earlier this month. Campus security and the New York Police Department moved in to suppress the peaceful protest, deploying pepper spray on the students. Congolese government forces and Rwanda-backed M23 fighters have agreed to a temporary ceasefire while they continue to negotiate a broader peace deal for the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Talks are being brokered by Qatar. The M23 has seized two major cities in eastern DRC, Goma and Bukavu, killing over 7,000 people and displacing another 1.2 million since the start of the year. Tunisian authorities on Thursday dismantled a makeshift camp in Sfax, a major transit hub for sub-Saharan African refugees. It was the second such destruction of refugee housing this month. Together, the demolished camps once housed some 7,000 people. It's part of a larger plan to expel undocumented sub-Saharan Africans from Tunisia without offering any alternatives or basic rights. This is one of the displaced migrants.
When I came, I was in the city, but there are times when I want to come here to use it as a crossing point to Europe. Each time, there's a dismantling of camps, and we have to change camps. These are the different difficulties we face here. When they come like that, they tear down all the houses and everything you have. You lose it in a blink of an eye, and those are the different difficulties that we face now.
In Guatemala, authorities arrested indigenous leader Luis Pacheco, accusing him of terrorism and what his supporters say is retaliation for leading nationwide protests in 2023 against attempts to derail President Bernardo Arevalo's transition to power. Pacheco is now serving as Arevalo's deputy energy minister. He's also the former president of the 48 Cantons, the governance authority that represents indigenous communities in the western highlands of Totonicapán. President Trump signed an executive order to expedite deep-sea mining permits, both in U.S. and international waters. That's despite relatively strict regulations on deep-sea mining established under the 1994 U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea. The U.S. is the only major coastal nation that has not ratified the treaty. Conservationists are calling for a moratorium on deep-sea mining to protect vulnerable ecosystems in one of the Earth's few remaining untouched habitats, which contain deposits of minerals like cobalt, zinc, and gold. And the mass shooter who opened fire on a 4th of July parade in 2022 in Highland Park, Illinois, received 7 consecutive life sentences Thursday, one for each of the people he killed. Robert Cremo III pleaded guilty in March. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, our interview with the acclaimed filmmaker, Ryan Coogler.
I don't know why the hell am I here. Traveling, I don't know why in the hell I'm here. Because the woman I'm loving, really don't care.
Travelin', Buddy Guy, a song featured on the soundtrack of the new movie Sinners. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with one of Hollywood's most celebrated filmmakers, Ryan Coogler. Although just 38 years old, Coogler has made a series of acclaimed hits, from Creed to the Marvel Black Panther films. He also co-produced the Fred Hampton biopic Judas and the Black Messiah. Born in Oakland, California, Ryan Coogler's first film was the Sundance and Cannes Award-winning Fruitvale Station from 2013 about the killing of Oscar Grant on the BART train platform. Ryan Coogler's latest film is Sinners, made with his wife, Zinzi Evans, a horror film set in 1932 in the Mississippi Delta during Jim Crow. The film has two stars. They're both actor Michael B. Jordan. He plays identical twin brothers, Smoke and Stack, who've just returned to their hometown after years living in Chicago working for the gangster Al Capone. The twins purchase an old sawmill from a racist white landowner to start a juke joint for the local black community when they're confronted by a supernatural evil. Oh, and did I say it's a vampire film? This is the film's trailer.
I've been all over this world. I seen men die in ways I ain't even know was possible.
Love you, brother. Be careful.
I will. With all the things that I seen, I ain't ever seen no demons, no ghosts, no magic. Till now.
Hey, get back inside.
Let me in, man. Some weird going on out here.
You keep dancing with the devil. One day he's gonna follow you home.
That's the trailer for the new critically acclaimed vampire horror film, Sinners. We go now to Oakland, California, where we're joined by the film's acclaimed director, writer, Ryan Coogler. His other feature films include Fruitvale Station, Creed, the record-breaking Black Panther, its sequel, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Ryan, it's great to have you back on Democracy Now! After we talked to you in Sundance more than a decade ago. This is an astounding film.
Oh, thank you, Amy. It's good to see you as well. And I appreciate the kind words about it. We worked really hard on it. Me and my wife, Zinzi Cougar, our partner, Seva Kohanian, and all of us at Proximity Media. This film meant everything to us. And it's been a joy to share it with the world and to have time to talk about it with people like you.
Well, talk about how you developed the idea for this and wrote it. I mean, this horror film, this film about everything from Jim Crow to slavery, the magnificent music, and the fact that you made it a vampire film.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's such a great group of questions. You know, like, to be honest with you, my family is like many families in California. We products of the second wave of the Great Migration, meaning that, you know, before California, my family was in the South, in the Gulf states primarily, but also some of them were in Mississippi. And it's ironic because with my grandmother and her mom before her and my mom are known for is their gumbo. They cook a style of gumbo that comes from Port Arthur, Texas, and as you know, that the dish is probably most famous in Louisiana. But it's combining a lot of different elements into one uniform dish that's beloved. My family is known for making some of the best gumbo, and this was my opportunity to make some cinematic gumbo. You know, I took some things that might seem disparate, you know, in a description. But I think they go very well together. You know, I grew up in Oakland, and one of the most important people in my life was my Uncle James Edmondson, who was a Mississippi man who married my grandmother's younger sister, Sammy, who the main character in the film is named after. But for a considerable amount of time, he was the oldest male member of my family, and I just really loved spending time with him. And all he wanted to do when he was off from work was listen to blues music, drink old Taylor whiskey, and maybe catch a game of San Francisco Giants on the radio, you know. And I associated that music with him. You know, I never felt like it belonged to me. It felt like it was music for, you know, for older people. But he passed away in 2015, and I was devastated. I was away from home as I normally was, making a film called Creed. When I got the news, and after he passed, I started to listen to old blues records to kind of remind myself of him. And if I did it enough, I would feel like he was there with me, almost like I was conjuring his spirit. And the base of the idea started with that. And when I started to do my research on blues music, specifically the Delta blues music that came out of that Mississippi Delta, I discovered that, you know, there's a firm argument to be made that this art form, the Delta Blues, is our country's most important contribution to global popular culture. You know, I think it's probably our most important artistic contribution to the world. And it was such a profound discovery this music made by people who were, you know, for all intents and purposes, living under a backbreaking form of American apartheid, you know, denied that humanity on a daily basis would create something artistically excellent that it would affect, you know, global culture, you know, from that time forward. And that was what I saw to make. I saw to make something personal and true, but also epic and mythical. You know, I grew up loving horror stories in literature and in cinema. So I combined that as well. You know, I had an appetite for showing more of myself, you know, after having over a decade working in franchise filmmaking, you know, if that makes sense. I was very passionate about those projects, but those projects weren't completely my own. So I was excited to incorporate some elements of genres and styles that I was interested in. But also, the last thing I'll tell you, Amy, was through my research into the music, I learned more about the music industry and the music business as it was built out, and how much the concept of genre is related to racism. You know, the classification of different types of music. You have a song sung by a black artist, and a white artist can sing that same song in homage to that artist. And the industry would say, hey, this black person's song, we're going to put that in one category. Back then, it might have been called race records. And then this other white musician will invent a new genre to keep a separation here of these groups of people. Maybe we'll call that bluegrass, or we'll call it country, or we'll call it rock and roll. You know, even though it was the same song sung the same way, they were looking at the color of the skin of the person who was singing it and enforcing that apartheid, even through the artistic business model. So I wanted to make a film that was kind of raging against the concept of genre and making the audience constantly question it, even while they were watching it, whether that's genres of music or genres of filmmaking.
This film is definitely genre-bending, genre-shattering, crosses so many genres. And again, it's about vampires. So before we go to this clip, can you set it up for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a clip with a character named Cornbread, who's played by the great Omar Benson Miller, and he was kind of hired to be the bouncer for the juke joint. And he's gone for a little bit. He goes to use the restroom, and he comes back. And since he's been gone, the character Smoke, who's one of the twins, is actually the older twin, played by Michael B. Jordan, and the character Delta Slim, played by Delroy Lindo, and the character Annie, played by Wumi Masaku. They've all had a supernatural encounter that's kind of raised their antennas to the fact that something is going on that might be greater than they can understand. And Wumi is a conjure woman who has a lot of experience with hoodoo and mysticism, and she's trying to you know lean on that knowledge to figure out exactly what they're dealing with. And a light bulb goes off when this character is struggling to enter the space.
Here's a clip from Sinners.
What y'all doing? Just step aside and let me on in now.
Why you need him to do that? You being strong enough to push past us?
Well, that wouldn't be too polite now, would it, Miss Annie? I don't know why I'm talking to you anyway. Smoke.
Don't talk to him. You're talking to me right now. Why you can't just walk your big ass up in here without an invite, huh? Go ahead. Admit to it.
Admit to what?
That you dead.
So you listening to this? Now we out here playing games, telling ghost stories in place of doing what we ought to do.
And what is it we supposed to be doing?
Being kind to one another and being polite. Now, we is one people, and we shouldn't go in barging into other folks' places uninvited, so.
You've been in and out of here all day. Ain't never need an invite then. Yeah, something ain't adding up.
Can I at least get my money?
careful.
Yep, it's scary. Sinners. We're talking to the acclaimed filmmaker, the writer of Sinners that just opened around the world. In fact, Ryan, you've just come back from London, right? I mean, I'm wondering, vampires, what it means to different cultures and what vampires mean to you?
That's a great question. I think that the vampire is one of those supernatural creatures that is kind of at the top tier of global consciousness. And I think that's because you've seen the concept of the vampire pop up in different cultures, almost independent of each other. You know, every place where you'll find human beings has a version of this creature. But it's also permeated, you know, two of the most widely spread storytelling art forms, the literature with Dracula, and all the books that have come after that, and also cinema with Dracula and its adaptations, and all the shows and films that have come, you know, after that. You know, you just got some great cinema that involves this mythical character. And for me, you know, what I think makes vampires so exciting is that they are very associated with human behavior. You know, they're associated with seduction and lust and material gain, the taboo. You know, and I think that vampires, unlike zombies and werewolves, which are the other, you know, other big, you know, aliens, which, you know, the other big ones, they maintain generally a large degree of their humanity, you know, which makes them more frightening, I think, but also more alluring, and you know, so it's just rich material, and you know, one of my favorite stories I ever read is a book by Stephen King called On Writing. I remember reading this book back in 2015 when I was working on Creed, and ironically, it was the same year my uncle passed away. And I remember him talking about his process, and he had an aside about a book he wrote called Salem's Lot, and it was so interesting where he talked about being inspired to write a movie about Dracula, but have him somewhere in America, you know. And he pitched his wife, Tabitha, what if I wrote a book about Dracula showing up in New York City? And she very famously said, according to the book, yeah, he would just get run over by a cab. You know, like the city was too big, it was too complicated for Dracula to even survive crossing the street. And allegedly Stephen King thought about that and took the note from his wife and then said, well, what if he arrived in a small town, you know, a sleepy American town that was kind of isolated? And then she kind of said, hey, maybe you got something there. And that became Salem's Lot. And I remember rushing off to read that book and being so moved by it. You know, and his conversation around it and on writing was that it was basically a combination of a book called Peyton's Place and Dracula. You know, and I just loved the book. And I always wanted to make something that felt like it, you know. So I took that opportunity here on this movie.
And talk about what it was like for you going into the Deep South to make this film. I mean, you made the film around New Orleans, is that right? And the culture there,
that's correct.
And your past work, and your journeys to Africa with Zinzi, your wife.
Yeah, absolutely. So this movie was a very interesting opportunity for me to do some research about my lineage. And I had that opportunity before with the Panther films. And in that situation, you know, me being a foundational Black American, you know, my family has been here, you know, for over 400 years, essentially, you know, in North America. But you know, the Panther films allowed me to travel back to the continent of Africa and spend time there and contemplate our distant ancestry as it relates to the continent, as it relates to the diaspora. This movie afforded me the opportunity to go back to my more recent lineage, 100 years or so, and go back to, the Mississippi, a state that I had never been to. I'm almost 40 years old, and my matrilineal grandfather was born in Mississippi. My uncle, who was so important to my life, was there until he was a young man, and I had never been. And it was a beautiful experience to go on that blues trail and spend time in those places. But it also was a harrowing experience at the same time. I went to the Dockery Plantation in the Mississippi Delta, which is, thought to be, maybe the place where the first true Delta blues song was played by a man called Charlie Patton. And when you go, you realize that they were making this music in slave quarters, and there was just this immense wealth that was owned by this plantation, like the amount of fertile land that you'll see, the amount of crops that you'll see, and that it was also a place where most people, were denied access to these resources. They were backbreakingly poor, and then at that time, often these were enslaved people, weren't being paid anything, So for me, to know that my family had history there, and I was touching down in that place for the first time, there was a level of guilt there for me. But there was also a level of wonder to know what my recent ancestors were endured, and were able to survive, and were able to make plans and affirm their humanity and affect the world, with their culture. I was really taken aback by it. And while I was there with my composer, Ludvig Göransson, who made our incredible score, our incredible soundtrack. I encourage folks to go out and go to their streaming platforms and listen to some of this great music that he made. He was born and raised in Linköping, Sweden, thousands of miles away from the United States. But his father, due to the fact that these black musicians weren't allowed to tour in the U.S., some of the British musicians who loved their music took them to Europe to tour. And Sweden was one of the places that they played. Where Ludvig's father saw these players, Howlin' Wolf, Albert King, as a teenager in Sweden, and was so inspired by their music that he became a blues guitarist, who then taught his son how to play. His son would end up being Ludvig and become, my good friend and the composer on all of my movies. Ludvig was there with me on a blues trail, and his father was there with him. It was a lifelong dream for his father to take this trip with him. So Ludvig, through researching this movie, was fulfilling, his 70-year-old father's dream, to see the birthplace of this music that changed his life so much. And that enabled me to understand just the global impact of these incredible human beings, who due to the shame and the misinformation associated with the time that they came up in, and the exploitation that was happening, the indignities that were happening, we don't look at that time enough, So I took the opportunity to do so very seriously. Mm.
So what's it like working with your wife? I mean, you credit her with so much. You co-produced the film with her. What's it like working with Zinzi on this masterpiece?
I mean, it's great, man. Zinzi is my favorite person in the world. I've been around her a long time, and still somehow it feels like it's not long enough, she knows me really well. We're very different, which is very helpful. We got two different communication styles, two different ways of seeing the world. So in general, if I have a situation that I can't crack, because she comes at things with a different angle, normally she can crack it very easily,
I remember first meeting you and Zinzi back in 2013. Now at the big premiere in New York, there she was, there she is,
yep.
Pregnant with your second child, the two of your second child.
But
this was 5:30 in the morning. It was at the Sundance Film Festival. You had just introduced Fruitvale. I said, would you be willing willing to come in at 5:30 because the show is at 6. You said, yep, I'm there. You said because your uncle, Clarence Thomas, not the justice, yeah. but the secretary general of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, had yeah. been on the show, loved it. And I said to you, can you give yeah. a message to him? Look directly into the camera, and you said, hi, Uncle Bud. But having yeah. said that, I wanted to go to the second part of that conversation. As you talked at that point, I think you were working at the San Francisco, the Juvenile Detention Center? You'd just come out with Fruitvale.
The Youth Guidance Center, yep.
So let's go to that clip.
I've never been homeless in my life. I always had a home. When I first went to film school, however, because it was such a sporadic thing, I went down to Los Angeles, you know, and I didn't have anywhere to stay yet. So I kind of had to jump start in classes and things like that. For about a week and a half, you know what I mean? I was you know, getting dressed in my car, spending most of my time in school, you know, until I found a place. But I bumped around quite a bit. I stayed with some Jesuits. You know what I mean? With a group of Jesuits that were in training, basically. I stayed with like a distant relative for a day or two. But I found my car to kind of be a safe haven for a little bit. You know, before I got an apartment.
So Ryan, that's you back in 2013, telling your life story. You had just done Fruitvale, first time working with, as you have from then on, with Michael B. Jordan. I don't think most people know that part of your life, what that meant.
Yeah, it happened very fast for me in terms of like the decision to go to Los Angeles and become a filmmaker, you know. And I went down there without everything figured out, you know, I ended up needing a lot of support from a lot of different people, and I'm still close with all of those people. I'm a product of so much support that's been poured into me, you know, from likely sources, but also very unlikely sources.
Is it true that Zinzi made your dream possible by paying $300 for your first movie writing software when you couldn't afford it?
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. Yeah. Yeah, Zinzi did buy me a Final Draft. One of the kindest things anybody's ever done for me. We were both student athletes. You know, we would buy each other things all the time, man. You know, but it was often, it was rarely something as forward thinking as that. You know, which kind of just speaks to who she is, man. And she does things like that all the time, like. Like she's an incredible gift giver.
I wanted to play that clip from 2013. It's not so long ago. It's a dozen years ago. And talk about yeah. what you negotiated in making Sinners, the arrangement you had with Warner Brothers. The New York Times reports Warner Brothers agreed to spend $90 million to make Sinners and agreed to give you a cut of gross ticket sales, now rare arrangement known as first dollar gross, meaning before they recoup their costs, you're getting money as well. Warner also agreed, and this is absolutely key, to relinquish its ownership of the film to you after 25 years. The Times reports, quote, some rival film companies were horrified that Warner Brothers would give a film away even after a period of time. Talk about these key yeah. components of your contract and why this was so critical for you, Ryan Coogler.
That's a great question. I mean, what I will do is I'll maybe add some context that maybe those articles didn't add. I'm not the first filmmaker to get any of these deals, you know. And Warner Brothers is not the first studio to provide these deals to a filmmaker. You know, I think that a lot has been made of my deal in particular. I'm not totally sure why, you know, I have my guesses, you know, but I've been in the industry long enough to know what kind of deals are possible, and nothing about this deal is a new thing, you know.
What's your guesses, Ryan?
It is not a con- I'd rather not say. but you know, like the attention on what's happening with this project, you know, outside of it as a piece of art and as a piece of commerce has been very interesting, you know. But for me, you know, this film was very important to me. As a writer director, I've made over $2 billion at the global box office. I'm not yet 40 years old. It's taken a lot time, commitment, energy, and I've missed out on a lot of things in my life. Making films that will always be owned by other people. For this one, because it was so personal, and because I had the ability to negotiate, you know, I asked for a few things that were very important to me for this project, you know, and for what it was about and what it meant to me and my family. And thankfully, you know, I was able to get those things I was asking for from Warner Brothers.
Well, Ryan, I know you have to go, but reading from The Guardian, you're widely considered the highest grossing black director in history. Your film Black Panther became the highest grossing film of all time, directed by an African-American director, grossing over $1.3 billion worldwide. I can't believe I'm saying to you, what do you have to say to young directors? Because you are a young director, but as Sinners comes out, what you want people to take away from it and how you want to inspire, I was going to say the next generation, but actually your generation.
Well, look, I'm what's called an elder millennial. You know, it's a generation of filmmakers coming up behind me, like that's Gen Z, they'll call them Zoomers. But for them, I think they have an incredible advantage to just having grown up with, you know, with smartphones in their pockets. You know, I don't think that's an advantage for their psychology. You know what I'm saying? Like, but it is an advantage for their filmmaking abilities. You know, to have access to this type of technology constantly. And I think that the movies that I see them make, when I look at things on the internet, I'm just always kind of blown away by the editing style and the way that they see the world. And we need their movies. You know, look, for me, A lot of my business success has been put in the context of me being black, you know. And I think that's a part of it, the issue when people write about, you know, what my films have done. You know, I'll say this: the year Panther 1 came out, yes, it was the highest grossing film ever made by a black person. It was also the highest grossing film domestically that year made by anybody, you know. And for some reason, that was never talked about, you know. And for me, what I'll speak to, and after coming off of, you know, this movie and researching Delta Blues music, you know, this music made by people who the state was built to make it so that they had nothing, to make it so that they had to be sharecroppers, you know what I mean, to make it so that they couldn't leave, to make it so that some of these plantations were so massive that they had their own currency and they own banking systems that they would pay them with, you know. They were able to make art that changed the world. That art became rock and roll. That art became the country music empire. That art became hip hop, you know. That art became house music. You know, like the fact that their stories were so amazing and so valuable, even though they were being told that they were worthless. You know what I mean? Even though I ever told that they didn't deserve anything, you know, that has stuck with me. And for me, you know, what I would say to not just young filmmakers, like I think that it's filmmakers of all ages that have yet to make their first movie. You know, so what I would say to aspiring filmmakers, you know, regardless of their age, aspiring filmmakers, filmmakers that are just removed from where you were when you met me in 2013, right? I would say, go make your movie. Go make your movie. Even if people are telling you that what you want to make a movie about is not important, keep going. Find a person who will support you. You know what I mean? Get better at your craft and go get it done. You know what I mean? So that you're no longer an aspiring filmmaker. You are just a filmmaker who's looking to make your next thing.
Acclaimed director Ryan Coogler, the writer, producer, director of the new supernatural vampire horror film Sinners. It's opened around the world. His past films include Fruitvale Station, Creed, and the record-breaking Black Panther and its sequel, Black Panther: Wakanda Forever. Coming up next, a less supernatural story. This one takes place now in Memphis, Tennessee, about two brothers fighting the richest man in the world, Elon Musk. Stay with us.
Two sides of a coin. Two sides of a war. Two sides of reality. One foot back in the door, and I still haven't learned my lesson. So I'll go all over again with you. I still haven't learned my lesson.
Seance by Ludwig Göransson and James Blake, a song featured on the new soundtrack of the new movie Sinners. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Memphis, Tennessee, where Elon Musk's artificial intelligence company, X, now called XAI, opened a massive data center known as Colossus last year that supports the chatbot Grok. The facility is next to historically black neighborhoods and runs on 35 methane gas-powered turbine generators, which emit significant amounts of nitrogen oxide and other toxic chemicals. The Southern Environmental Law Center says the turbines are operating without a permit. Those permits are the focus of a Shelby County Health Department hearing taking place today, Friday, as Musk says he wants to continue to expand his project. In February, Elon Musk explained why he decided to build Colossus in Memphis.
Well, we needed a building. We can't build a building, so we must use an existing building. So we looked for factories that had been abandoned, but the factory was in good shape, like the company had gone bankrupt or something. So we found an Electrolux factory in Memphis. That's why it's in Memphis, home of Elvis, and also one of the oldest. I think it was the capital of ancient Egypt.
This is Tennessee State Representative Justin J. Pearson, a Democrat who represents Memphis.
AI, Elon Musk company, is operating 35 gas turbines in southwest Memphis, in the neighborhood where myself and my entire family lives. This is horrific news. They are increasing the amount of nitrogen dioxide, which causes smog and continues to harm people with asthma by potentially 30% to 60%.
For more, we are joined in Memphis, Tennessee, by State Representative Justin J. Pearson and his brother, Keyshawn Pearson, Executive Director of Memphis Community Against Pollution. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Keyshawn, let's begin with you, as you're quoted all over about what's happening in your community, Memphis, Tennessee, where Dr. King was assassinated April 4th, 1968. Memphis, Tennessee, where Elon Musk wants to trying to expand Colossus. Explain what's happening in the community response and what you're planning to say today at the health department hearing.
What's happening in Memphis is a human rights violation. Elon Musk and XAI are violating our human right to clean air and a clean, healthy environment. Today, I plan to address the Shelby County Health Department in stating that this has not been a transparent process. This has been done in a clandestine way. And this is not the way that we can move forward healthily for our community. We need justice in processing. We need justice in the process. We need redress and repair. We don't need continual pollution. We've seen this story before, where polluters come to our city, whether it has been TVA and their Valero plant, sterilization services and their ethylene oxide plant. We have continued to be looked at as the path of least resistance. Today, I will make and explain to our Shelby County Health Department that we are not the path of least resistance. We are a resilient community that deserves the human rights of clean air, clean water, clean soil, and a healthy environment. We should not continue to bear the burden of the negative health impacts of this facility and its rapid pace and movement. A phrase and a term coined by Leah Thomas, environmental intersectionalism.
I want to ask you, Elon Musk claims he chose the former Electrolux building in Memphis because he wanted to get his AI applications up as fast as possible, within 122 days. He decided to use the abandoned building instead of a brand new one. Can you talk about what Electrolux was before the process it took for Musk's company XAI to purchase the building?
Electrolux was a company that scammed the city of Memphis. Electrolux came to our city and promised jobs, promised prosperity, similar to what XAI is doing, and then they left. They left without fulfilling the promise of jobs. They left without fulfilling the tax recommendations and the taxes that they said that they would provide that would elevate our community. They made promises and then they left and abandoned us. This is the same process that we've seen Elon Musk do in Texas as well as California. He will create a plan and then he will leave. And so what we're seeing right now is that this continual process is continuing to happen with a new tenant. Electrolux provided him the facility and he is scamming the city of Memphis while putting out pollution.
Keyshawn, I want to introduce your brother. This is an interesting inside-outside strategy. Tennessee Democratic State Representative Justin J. Pearson of Memphis, well-known to people around the country, the two Justins, the representatives who were forced out of the legislature, then reelected back in by their communities. Justin J. Pearson representing Memphis. Justin, thank you so much for being with us, State Representative. If you can talk about your opposition to Elon Musk and XAI, very interesting that your fellow Republicans, who have a supermajority in the Tennessee State House, recently passed a resolution recognizing Musk as, quote, a brilliant businessman who's saving lives and helping to restore America as a valuable ally of Donald J. Trump. Talk about your concerns about what this AI data center will mean.
Yeah. Look, my concern is that Elon Musk is buying and paying for access to pollute, harm, and hurt our community. Unfortunately, our mayors and elected officials and appointed officials, Mayor Lee Harris, Mayor Paul Young, Shelby County Health Director Michelle Taylor, and the Greater Memphis Chamber all decided that the community of 38109, where I live, could be on the auction block for Elon Musk to buy. And it is a horrible, horrendous project that is having serious ramifications for our community. The reason that in legislation that my colleagues passed praising Elon Musk, I put several amendments was to tell the truth, that Elon Musk is polluting the air of Tennesseans. He is continuing and perpetuating environmental racism and environmental degradation in our community. This project is an application for 15 gas turbines, but we know today that they have 35 turbines. And yesterday, a report showed 33 of those in operation, despite the fact that the mayor of Memphis said only 15 of them were being used because that's what XAI had told him. They are liars. They are abusing our community and they're exploiting us. And it's having horrible ramifications. 17.2 tons of formaldehyde being sprayed into our air because of these gas turbines. Over 130 tons of nitrogen oxide, making them a larger polluter than the Memphis International Airport, is happening right now in our community. And elected officials and appointed officials have a responsibility to the people who they were elected and appointed to serve, not to the billionaires and the oligarchs who are misusing and abusing their authority to hurt our community.
Can you talk about Memphis Mayor Paul Young after public pressure mounted, offering to earmark a portion of the roughly $15 million in tax proceeds from XAI's operation?
Yeah, I mean, Mayor Young's idea that he's going to give us tax money in place of our health and our lives is completely asinine, and it's an insult to the people in this community. But it isn't just Mayor Young who is problematic. It's Mayor Lee Harris of Shelby County, who has said nothing about this project since it started, and he was all praise and all happy-go-lucky about it, and now we can't find him. He's entirely invisible, despite the fact that the health department is under his purview. And so he hasn't come out with a statement saying that we need to protect our air, we need to protect our citizens, we need to protect our community. And that is giving license to Elon Musk and to XAI that they can't pollute our community. They can't hurt us without any ramification. But the people power that is rising up, the democracy that is being shown here by people of all constituencies, people all across our district and District 86, but all across this city and this county, is showing that we are not going to yield to the anti-democratic, anti-constitutional actions of people. We are not going to yield our lives and our lungs to Elon Musk, to Paul Young, to Lee Harris, to Michelle Taylor. We are not yielding our lives for the profits of the richest man in the world. This is ridiculous that the Greater Memphis Chamber and so many other people have literally decided that we can be sacrificed for the benefits of a data center and a supercomputer, and we not be included in the process, our voices not be heard. That isn't the way that economic development is supposed to go. And if that is the way that economic development needs to go in our city, we don't want it. It's an insult to the people in Boxtown and Westwood and West Junction and Walker Homes and Coral Lake that we are being treated this way, and that the people who have a responsibility and an obligation to do something about it are refusing to do so.
Democratic State Representative Justin J. Pearson, I wanted to extend my condolences on your baby brother's death. Not such a baby anymore, took his own life in December. And I understand, going back in time, when Tim was born, he needed a machine to breathe. Keyshawn, when he was born premature. Can you first talk about what you feel this all has to do with, communities that have cancer clusters and are in environmentally really fragile shape as a result of pollution?
Absolutely. So Keyshawn and I lost my middle brother, his baby brother, younger brother, Tim Pearson, in December, and we miss him every single day. One of the reasons that it's so important that we do something about this gun violence epidemic, and he was a proponent and a super advocate in our community and would have been at this public hearing today fighting alongside of us as well, but he's with us in spirit for sure. But he was born with asthma. My oldest brother born prematurely. My uncle sleeps with the CPAP machine. My auntie is currently fighting cancer, breast cancer right now, the same type of breast cancer that my grandmother died from. We know that environmental injustice is having a serious impact on the very lives and the health of the people in our communities. And these issues are interconnected. It is no coincidence that 75%, if you are Black African-American in this country, you're 75% more likely to live near a toxic, hazardous waste facility. It's no accident that in this district, in this community, we're four times likelier to have cancer in our bodies. It's no accident that in this community, there are over 17 toxic release inventory facilities surrounding us, now 18 with Elon Musk XAI plant. It is a consistent practice that is a part of the history of our country to first redline communities, force people to live in certain areas. And if you look at those same maps and where industrial facilities are being placed, they overlap. Our communities are being targeted. None of this is accidental or coincidental. We are being targeted, and our lives are continuously and consistently being hurt and harmed by the actions of corporations and by leaders like the Greater Memphis Chamber, Mayor Young, Mayor Harris, Director Taylor, who are not stepping up to the plate to say, you know what, we do need to find out more information about the environmental consequences before we green light projects like this. And if I can say this, look.
And we just have 20 seconds.
Oh, go ahead. Look, we have to fight. That is our responsibility. Fight, because clean air is a human right.
That's Tennessee Democratic State Representative Justin J. Pearson holding a news conference today at 4:30 in Memphis. And I want to thank Keyshawn Pearson, Executive Director of Memphis Community Action Pollution. We will continue to follow this story. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for an individual giving manager to support our fundraising team. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.